Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsible day for the 25th of Tammuz. It occurred to me that I've been recording these for a while now. We started at the 7th of Sivan, the day after Shavuot, and I haven't paused to tell you how much I appreciate you coming to listen to join me in these shiurim. I will try to do better about that in the future and try to remember to say it every day, because I very much do. It's one of my outlets, one of my main outlets for being able to share some Torah ideas that I find in the things that I study, and I greatly appreciate the opportunity to do so, and I always welcome feedback, critical, appreciative, whatever it is that moves you to share with me. My email is grothst@gmail.com, grothst@gmail.com. So thank you for joining me, and today, the 25th of Tammuz, we will study Rabbi Chaim Berlin on a question of shochtim and rabbis. These are two tshuvot that were written on the same day, on the 25th of Tammuz, to the same rabbi, a man from, he's the Rav of a place called Samila, which I wasn't able to find online. His name is Kolesnicker, and they seem to have been very good friends. It struck me, it's from a shoot called Nishmat Chaim, which was published posthumously, but Chaim Berlin is the son of the Netziv, and was always an important name in my household because my father had studied in Yeshivat Rabbi Chaim Berlin, which doesn't have any real connection to him other than having chosen him as the namesake for their yeshiva. But it's a name that has always loomed large in my existence, in my perspective of Torah and things like that. So therefore, it was a great opportunity for me to share some thoughts from Rabbi Chaim Berlin. We've seen Rabbi Chaim Berlin before in a conversation with Rav Kook. So here, this is Rabbi Chaim Berlin, Simon Pei Gimel. The first tshuva is in Responsum 83 in Shut Nishmat Chaim, and here it's talking about a shochet who is suspected of eating non-kosher. It is written, as I said, to this trend. It's written on the 25th of Tammuz of Tuf Resh Ayin Aleph of 5671, which is 1911. It's close to the end of Rav Chaim Berlin's life. He has moved to Israel, and he had been living in Yerushalayim, and he says now in the summer months, he moves to a place called Motza, which is, he mentions, is mentioned in the Mishnah, because it's cooler there. But he doesn't have all of his svarim with him there, so he can't answer all questions in the ways that he would want to. He also notes that he got one recent book of this man's that he very much enjoyed, and it's going to be the topic of our conversation, Hilchot Rabbah to the Shechita. It's a book about the laws of Shechita. And then he mentions that he heard that this Rav had written two other books that I looked up online, couldn't find them really, and he would hope to get them as soon as possible. Now, when he thinks about the responsa that that man had had in his books about Shechita, he says, you know, he's gotten to an advanced age, he's over 80, and it's he's left Yerushalayim about a month ago, and he's living in Motza. He tells us where it's mentioned in the Mishnah in Sukkah, and then he says it's because of the cold, because of the heat, but he doesn't have so many tzvarim, so he can't. And he says, "Vegam roshi kavid alai mila amik." I can't really go into things very deeply anymore. His age is getting to him, and he can't really delve into issues as maybe as he once had. So here's the question: you have the son of a shochet. So the acronym in the response to literature for a shochet is shin vav and then acronym bet, because it means a shochet ubodek, meaning that a person, when he qualified to be a shochet, to be a ritual slaughterer, would also learn how to check the knife, how to check the shechita, how to check for a trefos in the animal. So the man was qualified, supposed to be qualified, to take an animal from being alive to being ready to be cooked and eaten, to be salted and cooked and eaten, and to know how to do all those things. Now, many people, so this is the man of, this man is a son of a shochet. So very often in Jewish tradition, if the son was capable of fulfilling the father's role, the son had first crack at his father's job if he wanted it. So you have the son of a shochet. He wants to now become the shochet in that town. And the problem is that several people have testified about this son, this is 1911, that he is not careful about where he eats, and he's sometimes eaten in homes where there's good reason to suspect. There's no definition in our tshuva, in our responsum, as to what we call good reason, but there's good reason to suspect that if he eats in this home, it means that he's eating nevelot or trefot, meaning he's eating non-kosher meat. It's not horse meat, but it's cow meat, let's say, or kosher animal meat, but it's kosher animal meat that likely has not been shechted in the proper way. If that's true, it would mean that he's at least a chashud l'oto davar. Chashud l'oto davar means that in general halacha, when you have somebody who's generally a good Jew, but has some area of weakness, in that area of weakness, they lose their trustworthiness. We ordinarily assume that Jews are trustworthy, observant Jews are trustworthy. Let's say you have an observant Jew, ordinarily trustworthy, but there's some area in which that Jew is weak, as we all are weak in various areas. So chashud l'oto davar, somebody who is suspect in that particular area is generally not trusted in that area. If that's true, if this man is a chashud l'oto davar in the area of kosher meat, then it would seem like we shouldn't be able to trust that his shechita was okay, unless he brings his knife always to the shochet, to the rav of the town before he does his shechita, and that makes him a less good candidate for being the town shochet. So the question is, are the people of the town required to put up, just by virtue of the fact that the father had been the shochet all his life, and therefore they have some family claim to the position, is that a strong enough situation that they have to put up with this man who is a chashud l'oto davar? And you can't really trust his shechita unless he goes every time to the rav to get his knife checked for problems. Because what we're worried about primarily is, we're not really worried that he'll mess up shechita on purpose in the question. What we're really worried about, it seems, is that he'll find a nick in the knife and that invalidates the knife from doing shechita, but he won't care that much because he, apparently, by virtue of the fact that he's willing to eat treifa meat or nevela meat, doesn't really care about shechita, about ritual slaughter going right and going well, and therefore that's what they're worried about. Do they have to put up with somebody who has this problem in his status as the shochet, that he has to always get the knife checked to make sure that it's a good knife? The Rav Chaim Berlin, the Nishmat Chaim, says, I can't help but point out that I have deep problems in another direction. So, yeah, there's the problem of checking the knife before the shechita. That only works for somebody who all we worry is about the knife issue. But in this case, Rav Chaim Berlin says, what about Shehiya and Derisa? So it's worth remembering, or if you don't remember it, if you don't know it, then worth knowing, that the Gemara in Chulin at the beginning, and this got embedded in my memory because when I first arrived at Yeshivat HaRetzion in Tufshin Mem Bet 1982 in Elul, the Yeshiva started learning Chulin. So one of my first experiences of serious learning was with these five halachos that there are, these five main issues that there are in Shechita. So there's two of them are shehiya, of not taking too long during the course of shechita. That would be something you need to define carefully as to what qualifies as too long, but not taking long during the shechita. The fact is, one can take a long time for shechita, the one is continually involved in shechting, but pauses in the course of shechita can invalidate a shechita depending on how long they are. That's a shehiya. Then drahadrasa is, it's easily possible to kill an animal with a knife, but by pressing rather than slicing. And pressing, that's derisa. That's bearing down. It can even be that it looks like you're cutting it, but you're not slicing it. You are cutting through it by the pressure, and that's unallowed. That's a violation. That's a problem. That invalidates a shechita. The other three aren't the issue here for this tshuva, but they are, just for the sake of anybody who wants to know, they are chalada, where you go in the wrong place in the neck. You don't go in from the front of the neck. Then there's ikor, which is where one pulls out the simanim rather than cutting them. And hagrama is where one cuts the neck in the wrong place, in the above, too high or too low on the neck, to hit the simanim, to hit the place where shechita is supposed to occur. In any case, of those five, two of them are relevant here, because Rav Chaim Berlin is saying that the question phrases it as if it's only an issue of checking the knife, but as if there's no worry of shehiyah and hadrasa and drisa, because we think that in general, why would somebody who's got a shechita in front of him, has a knife in his hand, and has the possibility of doing a valid shechita, why would he not, and he knows how to do it right, why wouldn't he do it the right way? So the chazaka there is, the Chaim Berlin says, de lo shavik hetera ve'achil isura. The person will not leave the permissible way of doing something and eat iser, and eat prohibited materials, right? If I have, I'm shechting an animal, I can shecht it the proper way and produce kosher meat. And if I shecht it the wrong way, I'm going to produce non-kosher meat, right? So in general, we think that most people, even those who are willing to violate the Torah, it's not that they don't mind violating the Torah, it's that they don't find it worth their while to work at it. So if I come back from, if I'm at a event and there's non-kosher meat there, to go out to find the kosher meat you know, somewhere else, that much effort I'm not going to put into it. But the presumption is if there was kosher meat right next to the non-kosher meat, I would eat the kosher meat. Here too, if he already has the knife and it's valid, he'll do the shechita in the right way. But Rav Chaim Berlin says, this relates, I think we've seen this other times before, the whole question of how we treat and how we relate to Jews who sadly are not as observant as we'd like them to be. How do we conceive of them? So Rav Chaim Berlin says, in our times, when there are so many people who have abandoned observance, who, his phrase is, parku ol malchut shamayim, they have removed from themselves the yoke of heaven, meaning they don't care anymore about what Hashem says is right and wrong. So in this new generation, and many of them just don't care, and they have chutzpah about it towards Hashem, meaning they just really are completely flippant and completely glib and disregard Hashem's commands, so that the laws of the Torah are like a joke and they just really don't care and they're not embarrassed about it either. Hashem Yirachem, Hashem should have compassion on us. So in that situation, then he thinks that if somebody is a chashed l'otov davar and that person is in the new generation, he's not sure that checking the knife would be good enough, because because he thinks that there's a good likelihood that we have to treat this person as a mumor lahachis. A mumor lahachis is somebody, so mumor lahachis literally means somebody who has abandoned observance in one area, but he's done it to anger God. The definition of anger God is a complicated one, but one of the standards is if the person is willingly shavik heter revachal isura, the person will ignore heter that's right there and instead ignore permissible foods that's right there and instead eat prohibited food. So that's a mumor lahachis. In a mumor lahachis situation, and that situation, really, we can't trust those people on a whole broad range of things. So the Rav Chaim Berlin is saying, reading your book, in which you discuss the issue as if it's a question of whether or not this person has to get his knife checked all the time, and whether the community has to put up with a shochet, has to install a shochet who has to have his knife checked all the time. Rav Chaim Berlin is saying, I think there's a much broader question. Can we trust this person's shechita at all? Because in our generation, seeing somebody willing to ignore a certain area of halacha, he says, really implies that person doesn't care about that halacha at all, and that might make them a mumor lahakis, and if it makes them a mumor lahakis, we have much broader problems than checking the knife. But he's not saying that lahalacha lamaisa. He says he's not willing, he's not ruling on that as a practical matter. And he points out that Eliyahu and Yeshaya, the Gemara things, were punished. The Midrashim think that they were punished al shalimdu chova al Yisrael, that they were punished for speaking negatively of the Jewish people, kanoda, as is well known. So in the case of Eliyahu, after Eliyahu on Mount Carmel, shows everybody that Hashem is the true God, and the whole people say Hashem Hu Elokim. Then Izebel threatens to kill him, and he has to run away, and there's a whole story, and he gets to Har Sinai, and he has this experience of seeing Hashem, and he goes out, and Hashem passes by, and there's a big, whatever, it's a whole story. There's a big earthquake, there's a big fire, there's a big storm, and Eliyahu knows it's not Hashem, and then there's a cold Mamad Daka, there's this still silent voice, and Eliyahu knows that's Hashem, and Hashem says, what are you doing here? And Eliyahu twice says, I'm here because the Jewish people are because I stood up for you, and the Jewish people are persecuting me. And Chazal see that as the wrong answer, and that he spoke evil, ill of them. Yeshayahu, early on in the book, also speaks ill of the Jewish people, because Hashem says, I want to send you to be a messenger to my people. And Yeshayahu says, who am I? Because I'm a person of unclean lips, living among a nation of unclean, of people of an unclean nation. And then there too, the Gemara understands what happens to the Navi as being a rebuke to Yeshayahu over that. So Chaim Berlin is saying, we have this tradition that it's a very bad idea to speak ill of the Jewish people, and therefore I'm not going to paskin that way, but I want you to know that on my own, I would not know, I would not be confident that I could trust this Shochet that he didn't do Shehiyah or Hadrasa, and that's what he has to say on that issue. So the first, we're actually going to see there are two Tshuvot that he wrote to the same man on this same day. They're separated in the book, I don't know why, but they're clearly part of the same letter. So the first one was about this question of a shochet who becomes suspect in his observance for a particular reason. The suspect reason here is that we see him eating, or that it's known that he eats in homes where the meat is likely not kosher. It's likely nevela or treifa meat. Definition of likely would be something to investigate further if we were going to rule on this practically. But the sum total is that people assume that this shochet obodik, this person, is suspect. He has a family legacy to this position, and therefore he thinks he should be allowed to have the position. The question was framed as this, does the community have to put up with him even though it will obligate checking his knife all the time? And Reb Chaim Berlin is saying, I think there's an additional issue, that additional issue being that in our time, when somebody abandons observance, he's not sure, this is in contrast to many other people, but he's not sure that those people don't become considered mumarim lahachis, that they would be thought of as being more seriously deficient, that it's a rebellion rather than just a yielding to temptation, and therefore you'd have a problem. That's tshuva number one. Second tshuva, in Nishmat Chaim, also a very brief one, in Simon Kuf Samak Vav 166, again to the same rabbi from Smila, on the 25th of Tammuz, also from Tef Reish Ayin Aleph, 1911. Here in this tshuva, he calls it Shnat Nedari Bakoach, following the rabbinic tradition of finding creative ways of naming years that have to do something with some principle of what some idea, some phrase from Tanakh. So in this situation, the question was about Hasagat Gvul of a particular Rav who had been the Mashkiach, who had a position supervising the kashrut at a certain factory, which is a financially remunerative position. It makes him some money, makes him a living. And he wants to know if he really has the right to it, if somebody else comes in and says he can do it, you know, cheaper, whatever, he finds a way to get the job from the guy. Is that a Hasagat Gvul issue? Let's remember, the Nalacha, the assumption was, and this doesn't match with the competitive streak within capitalism, and the idea that capitalists have, the competition is good because it encourages and forces people to improve, which has its valid points. But in Halacha, there was also the concern about Hasagat Gvul, about stepping on something that belongs to somebody else. So the question that they were dealing with was whether or not it's considered Hasagat Gvul if there's a Rav who's the Mashgiach. So if today's terms, it would be, let's say, the OK Labs has a certain position with a certain company, and some other kashrut organization swoops in and says, we'll do it for less, or whatever, and they find a way to get that out of them. Does that competition run against the halacha? So Rav Chaim Berlin says, you know that all of the laws of chazakot that we think about in these terms are amumot, are not clear at all in the various ways which they work. They are hararim hatluyim bis'ara, which is a phrase that the Gemara uses regarding certain halachot that don't have much textual support. They're like mountains hanging by a hair. I think that the Gemara talks about Hilchot Shabbos, Harakarim Tulim Zazara, and they have very little source. This, the laws of Chazakah, the laws of who has the right to what positions, have very little textual sourcing in the Gemara, and most of their halachos come from the poskim, come from the Maharik and the Maharashtam and the Chatam Sofer and people like that, and he doesn't have those sources in Moshav Motza. And besides that, he says, you know, if you know this Rav who came to you and told you the story, and you know him well enough that on his behalf, that there's a rebuke hidden here, but it's being said very gently. If you know that on his behalf, it's worth your while to violate the fact that the Torah says, Shamoa ben Achechem. When Moshe Rabbeinu is telling judges their job, he says, Shamoa ben Achechem, listen to the disputes between your brothers, which assumes that both of the disputants are there. This Rav seems to have heard only from the rabbi who had the position at the factory and was complaining that it had been taken away from him. So he says, if you're going to rely on, there are some opinions in halacha who say that you can listen to one side even before you hear the second side, if you think that it's worth relying on that minority opinion on behalf of this Rav, then Hashem should pay you back for the good deed that you're doing, that you're going to find a way to help out this Rav. He refers to a Gemara in Shabbos, which Rava says, I should get rewarded from heaven. This is in Shabbat, Kuf Yutet Amar Aleph. Rava says, I should get rewarded in heaven because when a Tsurba Me Rabbanon, when a Torah scholar came before me for a judgment, I wouldn't go to sleep until I found some way to find his schut, to find his merit. In other words, Rava is saying that his connection to Torah scholars was so strong that he was generally so confident the Torah scholars would not do the wrong thing that he would seek the way to find their right. Now, that's a Gemara that in our times can certainly be misused because it assumes the Torah scholars generally do the right thing. There are certainly other cases, even in the Gemara, where Torah scholars do something that's not considered the right thing. So how Rava really applied that and the definition of that, you'd have to know Rava's biography in great detail to be sure you understood it fully. Rav Chaim Berlin is saying to this guy, if you feel that you're so close to this Rav and you know him so well that when he comes to you with a claim, that you're willing to believe his claim fully and to rely on that to act upon it, even though the halakha generally is that judges should hear both sides and that shouldn't even listen to one side, not in the presence of the other side, because even that might tilt their view in the wrong way. There is a minority of people who find it possible to listen, who are makulous, so you can listen to one side without the other side being present there. And you have this one Gemara that Rava says, when it came to Torah scholars, he always found ways to find their merits. So if you're so convinced of it, then that's great and good for you. But Rav Chaim Berlin says, Aval Anochi, but me, Meirachok, who is, you know, operating from afar and is discussing this with you by long distance, and I don't know this Rav, and I don't know his conduct in general, and I certainly can't reach the certainty that he deserves my help and that I should find whatever ways I can to help him, so then I can't get involved, Rav Chaim Berlin says, until both sides want me to get involved and both sides present their opinions to me, and then I could try to weigh the two sides. In other words, it's very, he's being very, not very subtle, but he's being relatively subtle about it in terms of saying that it's not his place to hear one side of an argument and then come to a decision, but I know that you, my friend, are a great Rav, and you have lots of halachic knowledge and ability, and I'm sure you'll find the way to help the people in your community do what needs to be done, and you'll find the right path forward, but you have to forgive me, I'm not getting involved here. But in order that you don't come to me and you get nothing out of it, which is interesting because we've just seen a previous tshuva where he already gave something out of it. So he in separating these into two tshuvot means for this one not to be an empty conversation, a conversation where you got nothing out of it. I'm going to share something with you. I was asked, he said, from one of the great scholars of Yerushalayim, he doesn't name him, who raised the following issue. There is an opinion of Rabbi Natan in Tosfot Shabbat Kuf Mem Chet, and the Rush quotes it as well in Makot, that who says that when you borrow something, an item, meaning in the halacha, there's two words for borrowing. There's she'ela and there's halva'a. Halva'a generally means money, and she'ela generally means an object. So in halva'a, in money, the money that I borrow from you, generally I don't give you that same money back, because if that was what I was going to do, what's the point of borrowing it? I borrow money to spend it on something, and the plan is that I'll pay you back other money to compensate you for it. But when I borrow, when I am sho'el an item, when I borrow an item, the expectation is that item is the one that's coming back to you. So, theoretically, the assumed term of such loans could be different. It could be that when the Gemara says clearly that stam halva'a is 30 days, if I borrow money from you and we don't set a time for return, the general assumption the Gemara thought was that the loan is for 30 days. Is that true for a she'ela, for an actual item? I borrow today, for sure, for example, it wouldn't be true of a car. If I borrow your car for something, you lend me your car, you do me the favor, you certainly don't mean that I'm going to borrow it for 30 days, and nobody thinks that way. There is this Rabbeinu Tam in Tosfot and Shabbat, and the Rush quotes it as well in Makot, who says that Stam She'ila is Shloshim Yom. The general assumption is that it's 30 days, like a halva'a, like a monetary loan. And the problem that this Rav had raised with Rav Chaim Berlin is that it seems to be against an explicit discussion in Chagiga, Chaf Bet Amid Bet. The Gemara there says, "Demana l'shiva yomei lo moshli inishik," that with clothing, people don't lend it even for 7 days. So that sugya seems to say, not only is it not 30 days, it's not even 7 days. So Chaim Berlin says, when I first thought about that, when the question was first posed to me, I was very upset, I was very surprised and bothered. How could it be that Rabbeinu Tam would ignore an explicit sugya, would just lose track, would just forget that a standard that we all, that most of us, I assume, can't and don't live up to, that the assumption was that Rabbeinu Tam would clearly know the Gemara and Chagiga well enough, there was no chance the answer is, oh, you know what, when he was thinking about the sugya in the context of Shabbat and in the context of borrowing, in the context of monetary versus item borrowing, that throwaway line in Chagiga didn't occur to him. that's not an answer, right? That would be an answer that would greatly trouble Rav Chaim Berlin, because that's not the way Rishonim are supposed to work. Rishonim know these Gemaras, and the Gemara is, especially Rabbeinu Tam, the Gemara is at his fingertips, and it's unacceptable to say such a thing. So Rav Chaim Berlin is very bothered when he hears the question. He looks and checks in Sfarim, and he says, "Vahir Hashem Einai, Hashem showed me the way, and I found the Shita Mekubetzin Bav Metzia," quotes the Ramach, who was a student of Maram of Mirutenberg. So this is the late 13th century, early 14th century. The Maram Mirutenberg passed away in 1293, I think. That's the famous story where the Maram was taken prisoner by a local government, and they took him prisoner expecting to ransom him from the local community, and he refused to let the community do it because he said, and this is based on the Gemara, but he said, if you let them kidnap me, take me into prison and pay money for it, they'll do it more in the future. And in fact, he passed away in prison. This Ramach was one of his students, and the Ramach raised that question about Rabbeinu Tam. So the first step is, Rav Chaim Berlin is relieved or happy or whatever the right words would be, that the question at least was thought of before this generation. Meaning, it would have been doubly troubling if not only had Rabbeinu Tam missed that sugya, but everybody who came after missed it too. So at least, Shittu Mikubetz, a quote to Ramach, who found that problem as well. Omnam, lo nacha da'ati, it wasn't good enough for me that Rabbeinu Tam himself would forget an explicit Gemara. And he says, v'chova aleinu l'mashkune nafshin be'ad Rabbeinu. It's our obligation to sort of put our souls on trial on behalf of Rabbeinu Tam. It's an attitude towards Rishonim and Achronim, I don't know if you always know, to recognize that there are certain kinds of mistakes that should be unimaginable to us, even as we recognize that Rishonim and Achronim, that great Torah scholars, are human beings. There are certain kinds of errors that should be unthinkable. And this would be one of them. Rabbeinu Tam would come up with a whole theory and lose sight of an explicit Gemara. And then he says, truth is, I thought of an easy, good answer, and I have a way to do it. So theoretically, you'd think, or I would think, he's going to now share the answer. And I would hope he shared the answer with the Rav West in the question. But then he says, "Ulekayem mashepirshu basfarim," to fulfill what he had seen in certain books. And I couldn't find where this is from, but he quotes a statement, a sort of an inference, where it says, "Liftor michaverom mitoch tvar halacha." That's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says that one should. When one is parting from one's friend, Jews ideally should part mitok divar halacha. They should share a word of not just Torah in general, but halacha, right? A conclusion of halacha before they part from each other. But Rav Chaim Berlin knew of another way of reading it, that it said, not when it says mitok divar halacha, it doesn't mean just that they were talking about halacha. It means shepir shumi emtz divar halacha, that we really, almost the opposite of what it seems to mean in the simplest sense, that it should be from within the course of a halakha conversation that has not yet come to an end. The reason why you'd recommend that is because it would mean that they would have continuing halakhic thoughts as they go forward. And the tayinul haniyach davar be'entz, to leave it there. And why? Because that will lead each person to remember the other and then to continue the conversation, right? Not because you don't want to leave a halakha unresolved. So you end the conversation, if you have to, in the middle, and that will bring people back together, and they'll remember each other, and they will think to the next time they can talk, so they can finish it. And therefore, he finishes the letter like this, saying, so I'm sending you this idea, I'm sending you this question, and I'm hoping to hear your answer, and that will help me think about it, and I'm ready to hear your answer. So, and he wishes him well, and he closes the letter. So Rav Chaim Berlin is a fairly unknown figure, unfortunately, known by name, but not as well known perhaps by his ideas and by his Torah, because Nishmat Chaim, as we've said, was published only posthumously, only after he passed away. So seeing two of his short letters for the 25th of Tammuz, we've seen first his worries about how we define non-observance in his time, and whether non-observance in his time could be defined as just a momentary lapse that would lead to somebody being called a chashud lo to davar, being called suspect in that issue, but that would only require a shochet, a ritual slaughterer, to have his knife checked, or by virtue of the fact that the new generation, when they abandon something, they abandon it so fully that they might be considered mumarim lahachis, and that would mean that his shkita in general would be problematic. Rav Chaim Berlin himself has that problem, that has that concern. He doesn't want to rule on it. He doesn't want to speak ill of the Jewish people, but he has that concern because of this phenomenon. And then the second one, where he doesn't really answer the question, he thinks that it's a problem to help a Rav hold on to his hashkacha, to his supervision over a kashrut in a factory, based only on that Rav's side of the equation. He thinks it's probably better to hear both sides, but he encourages his friend, if he's confident that this Rav is a Tzur B'mei Rabban, as a Torah scholar deserving of it, that he could help him out. But he, Reb Chaim Berlin, doesn't feel comfortable doing so from afar. And then he closes with a question, just so that the other man can continue their conversation along Torah lines, of how it could be that Rabbeinu Tam seems to ignore a Gemara in Chagiga about how long people tend to borrow particular objects. The Gemara, Rabbeinu Tam, says it's Stam for 30 days. The Gemara in Chagiga seems to say it's not even for 7 days, let alone for 30. And he leaves that in the middle, so we can leave that in the middle as well. And once again, expressing my thanks to you for sharing this with me, for this time with me, for joining me, and with the hope that maybe you'll be in touch and let me know how it's going, how, what you like, what you don't like, and also maybe tell your friends about it so we can have we can help spread Torah, the Torah of our great respondents, into the future. Have a great day, 25th of Tammuz.